available on digital media, iTunes podcast, smartphone apps, and from the online website. This is Outlook, the talking newspaper for Coventry.
Welcome to Outlook. This edition is being recorded on Wednesday, the 15th of October, 2025. I'm Peter Walters. Coming up in this week's programme, we're at Newbold Pacey in South Warwickshire. We're listening to The Secrets of the Pyramids, looking behind the scenes at Highclere Castle, and also attending the BBC CWR Make a Difference Awards. All that to come, plus sport, post-back and usual features. But first, here's the news, read by our local readers, Peter and Elaine.
Outlook News.
Some of you will know that tree climbing championships are regularly held in the War Memorial Park. Last weekend, the National Ploughing Championships were held near Orsley. The plough-offs, or soil sports, welcome more than 250 ploughmen and women using a mix of heavy horses, vintage tractors and modern counterparts to vie for various titles. Sue Frith, Chief Executive of the Society of Ploughmen, said the annual event was very significant for the farming community. Considering what farmers are going through, it's something for them to enjoy and take them back a little bit to how it used to be. We're delighted to come to Orsley this year. The championships contribute greatly to the local economy because all the people taking part and the volunteers who set the event up and all the visitors, they stay in accommodation from caravan sites or pubs and go to the shops. She explained the event was a multidiscipline affair, with sections determined by what was pulling the plough, whether animal or machine. Points can be awarded for straightness and neatness of the furrows. Dating back to 1951, the 74th event is being hosted by Martin Brandreth, the tenant of Alton Hall Farm in Orsley. He described it as a proud moment. "It's definitely a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to host it in this area. I'm really chuffed about it. People came from all four corners of the country to take part, from Scotland down to the south and over to Wales. There were demonstrations of steam ploughing engines and even of a ploughing tank, plus displays of vintage tractors and equipment. We are thrilled with the level of interest this year," said Stephen Cheeseman, chairman of the Society of Ploughmen. "It's a testament to the enduring appeal of the championships and the skill, passion and heritage behind the sport of ploughing. The major categories with their winners were horse ploughing champion Martin Kurzweil from Hampshire, high cut champion Sean Garrod from Norfolk, vintage champion Richard Ingram from Atherston, and the supreme champion Ashley Boyles from Market Raisin in Lincolnshire.
There is a possibility that Warwickshire will become a county divided. Some politicians are pushing for it to be split in two, as the government moves ahead with plans to give local areas more decision-making powers via devolution. The plans mean that none of the six councils in Warwickshire will exist by 2028. They include the overarching Warwickshire County Council and the five lower-tiered district and boroughs. So, now, the question is, what will replace them? There are two options recommended in an independent report commissioned by the local councils. Either to split the county in two, north and south, single-tier authorities, or to replace the existing structure with a single large council. The two-council argument revolves around smaller councils being able better to serve the needs of residents in areas viewed as economically or socially different. It would see the district councils of Stratford and Warwick merge to create South Warwickshire, while Rugby, North Warwickshire and Nuneaton and Bedworth would come together to create North Warwickshire. Ultimately, the government would decide what happens, but the districts and boroughs are being invited to express their preferences ahead of the final decision. They have until the 28th of November, but there's far from unified opinion about what Warwickshire's new setup should look like. So far, Liberal Democrat-controlled Stratford, Green-led Warwick, Tory-run North Warwickshire and Labour-led Nuneaton and Bedworth have all expressed a preference for splitting the county in two. Labour-led Rugby is currently on the fence, although suggestions are that councillors are likely to lean towards a single authority. While the current top-tier authority, Warwickshire County Council, led by Reform, is, or indeed voted yesterday, for a single authority. Next year's elections in Rugby, Nuneaton and Bedworth, therefore, will be the last under the county's existing structure. Elections for the newly formed council, or councils, will then be held in 2027. At that point, a shadow operation will swing into action until the new authority or authorities take full control in 2028.
People have been invited to take part in building a huge cardboard model that will echo the old Coventry Cathedral to mark 85 years since the Blitz. Taking its cue from the cathedral ruins, organisers said the artwork would be constructed from thousands of pieces of cardboard. The installation, designed by Olivia Grosstet, will form a temporary landmark described as a monumental structure inspired by St Michael's Cathedral, standing about 20 metres high. People are being invited to free workshops, which will be held in Draper's Hall from the 10th to the 15th of November. Coventry City Council says we need communities of Coventry to play their own part in the city's history and help us build this structure. Once complete, it will be situated in Broadgate and will be put there on the final day of the workshops. The artwork will then remain until 3 p.m. on the Sunday, the 17th of November, for people to capture the moment and invite family and friends to be part of the weekend. Those attending on the Sunday are invited to assist in the demolition of the building to reflect the sudden loss of the old cathedral on the 14th of November 1940. Councillor Abdul Salam Khan said the structure would act as an iconic centrepiece to the city's commemorations of the Blitz. He said, what's particularly special and important in this project is the engagement of local people and our communities in creating and building this iconic structure. Being part of such a wonderful project engenders a sense of community spirit and of resilience in pulling together and creating something special. Attributes that Coventry people themselves showed during such a terrible period in the city's history. A vigil and civic service are planned for the 14th of November to remember the 550 people killed in the 12-hour raid by German bombers during World War II.
I've got my life back. Those are the words of a grateful former chef who was thanked a Coventry homelessness charity for helping him rebuild his life after he spent 18 months sleeping in a tent. Dean was homeless and living in a tent by a brook before Emmaus Coventry and Warwickshire gave him a place to live and the support he needed to turn his life around. To mark last Friday's World Homeless Day, Dean shared his experience of homelessness and his gratitude to the charity. Emmaus Coventry and Warwickshire provides a home, meaningful work opportunities, training and tailored support for up to 17 people who have experienced homelessness. It also helps them to regain confidence, skills and independence through its social enterprises and community life. Dean became homeless after years of caring for his mother. He said, "My life was once pretty good. I had a great job as a chef and I lived with my mum in her rented house. Unfortunately, my mum became ill, so I left work to become her full-time carer. 4 years later, she sadly passed away and I took over the tenancy of the house and got a job working as a school cleaner. Things could have started to look up, but then I had a car accident that left me injured and unable to keep my job. In the end, After about 6 months of spiralling into debt, I was told I was going to be evicted. With nowhere to go, Dean was homeless for almost 18 months. I slept in a tent alongside a brook. It was the cold temperatures that really got to me. Each day seemed like it lasted a fortnight. Some people might think it sounds like an adventure, but when it's below zero outside and you've got a beard full of ice, it's not fun. The turning point came when he was introduced to a charity that later led him to Emmaus Comedy in Warwickshire. He likened Emmaus to a stepping stone to getting back into reality. They gave me my own room and a reason to get out of bed each morning. Emmaus has given me back the confidence that seemed to slip away when I was homeless. My sense of pride returned as well. I was used to be a smartly dressed person and I feel like myself again. Emmaus gave me my life back and I'm incredibly thankful.
Coventry's Ring Road has been named as one of Britain's weirdest roads after a study to find Britain's most unusual roads, and it led to the Ring Road being placed sixth. Locally, the Ring Road has long raised eyebrows, from those who are baffled as to how people struggle to use it, to those who find it tricky to negotiate. Describing their first encounter with the Ring Road, one user said, "I can remember clearly the first time experiencing what can only be described as a full-size, real-life scale extra track." Infamously, the Ring Road sees vehicles share the same exit-entry ramps, which drivers admitted to finding challenging. One contributor to a driving forum says, "Vehicles sharing the same exit-entry ramp is mental. You get used to it after a while, but it's very unnerving when you first use it." Britain's seven most unusual roads are the Zigzag Hill in Dorset, which is Britain's bendiest mile, the Electric Bray in Ayrshire, Scotland's gravity-defying illusion, Swindon's Magic Roundabout, the multi-directional marvel, the M62 at Stott Hall Farm, the house that split a motorway, Leeds City Centre, the one-way labyrinth, Coventry Ring Road, the concrete collar, Billac Nabar, Scotland, Britain's Alpine Challenge. British drivers face some genuinely unique roads that you simply won't find anywhere else in the world, says Ben Wellham, the motoring expert. While some are challenging for drivers, others are just plain strange, and many have become destinations in their own right, attracting drivers from seeking to experience the curiosities for themselves.
I'd just like to add the Hemel Hempstead roundabout to that list, which you can go either right or left as you join it, and then round several mini roundabouts. First time you take someone who's never been there before, they think you've gone mad as you turn right onto the roundabout. It was 20 years ago last Tuesday that Yoko Ono visited Coventry Cathedral to plant a new pair of oak tree saplings as a symbol of peace. At the event on the 14th of October 2005, Yoko revealed to hundreds of people who'd gathered that the city was where her and John Lennon's campaign for peace had begun in 1968. "It was here in Coventry the first public manifestation of our message occurred, so it's great to be back here 37 years later to continue something we started together. John would have loved it," she said in 2005. The pair's original visit to the site was to submit their Acorns for Peace sculpture in an exhibition at the cathedral. The artwork consisted of a circular white wrought iron seat surrounding two acorns, which would grow over time inside as a living sculpture. However, their visit in 1968 caused a row with cathedral authorities, who ended up moving the installation, infuriating Lennon, while the acorns were dug up and stolen a few weeks later by Beatles fans. Last year, Pete Chambers of Coventry Music Museum said that members of the cathedral made the mistake of questioning Yoko on whether the project was even art. "By all accounts, this resulted in a lot of shouting," he said. Later, John got his trusty chauffeur to come back to Coventry and take the bench away. The planting in 1968 was one of the couple's first missions of peace and an entry into the prestigious Exhibition of British Sculpture, which was being held in the cathedral's ruins at the time. The nuts were buried beneath the circular white wrought iron seat on grass outside the Chapel of Unity, with the acorns planted in east and west positions, symbolising the meeting of the couple and the union of their two cultures, and marking the start of their campaign for peace with a plaque that read, "Yoko by John, John by Yoko." Now, the two oak trees, which were planted by Yoko Ono in 2005, stand in Cuckoo Lane, close to the cathedral ruins. Last year, the acorns went on display at the Beatles Museum in Liverpool, after a retired police officer found them in his possession. Former Warwickshire Police Traffic Sergeant Mike Davies said he discovered them in a box while tidying up. He said they'd been brought into Nuneaton police station by a man who'd been caught drink driving outside Bedworth. He said the driver and his girlfriend were fans of the Beatles who'd returned to the cathedral after the planting ceremony and had stolen the acorns, coating them in clear nail varnish to preserve them. Meanwhile, a replica bench, made by the theatre absolute play The Lennon Bench, is now on display at Coventry Music Museum.
Coventry has received nearly £900,000 in funding to tackle homelessness and rough sleeping. The money will fund a range of initiatives focused on helping vulnerable individuals to find stable housing. It will be used to support families in temporary accommodation, to expand drug and alcohol treatment services, and to strengthen rough sleeping prevention work across the city. It will also fund tailored services to improve quality of life, including mental health support, community-based programs, and access to long-term housing. Families in temporary accommodation will be prioritised. Funding will go towards essentials such as food, travel, laundry and Wi-Fi. MP Taiwo Awotamai said the funding comes amid record high numbers of families in temporary housing, with nearly 170,000 children affected. Since 2010, rough sleeping has more than doubled, including a 46% rise in Coventry in just 1 year, from 2023 to 2024. Coventry City Council has been allocated more than £893,000, of which around £696,000 will go towards preventing rough sleeping. Almost £162,000 will help young people in temporary housing, and the best part of £36,000 will be invested in drug and alcohol support programmes. Muzawatamai, MP for Coventry North West, said, "Homelessness and rough sleeping are real and growing challenges in Coventry. Every year I support residents who fear losing their home, and many more are just one unexpected step away from the same position. No one in our city should be left without a safe place to sleep or the chance to rebuild their life."
Details have emerged on two very distressing distraction burglaries in Coventry. Police revealed that there were two incidents within less than 24 hours and have issued a warning to locals to be on their guard. And now some further details have been provided about one of these distraction burglaries. This was in Brookside Avenue. The Wobbly local policing team said that the suspect posed as a healthcare worker to trick their way into the property. A distraction burglary has been reported on Brookside Avenue, where someone posing as a healthcare worker has gained access to the property, the team said in an online update. A similar incident has happened elsewhere in Coventry, and officers are on the case. The other incident took place in Mardor Close. Both took place within hours of each other on Thursday, October the 9th. Police continued, "The incidents occurred between 12 p.m. and 3 p.m. and it is believed that they stole valuables when entering the houses. Coventry police are investigating and are keen to hear from anyone who thinks they may have been targeted by the same people. If you think your house or someone you know has also been targeted, call 101 to let us know what you know.
Residents have called for a services building used by boating at a Coventry beauty spot to be saved. Sutton Stop at Hawkesbury Junction is known for its picturesque beauty and historic bridges and buildings. It is a popular area for boaters, residents and walkers alike, not to mention drinkers and diners, thanks to the much-loved Greyhound pub nearby. But there is a concern about the services building located there, which has been closed to boaters for some time. An online petition has been started urging the Canal and River Trust, which operates the site, to restore and reopen the building. The petition set up by Karen Spooner reads, "This is a vital resource for boaters as well as those travelling through Hawkesbury Junction, and it also positively impacts the local area's economy and community spirit. The canal network is a cherished part of our heritage and lifestyle, and the undermining of its services can have far-reaching consequences. Removal of the building is not a sustainable or community-focused solution. Instead, Canal and River Trust should prioritise responsible management and maintenance to restore the services building to full operation." The Trust responded to the petition to tell us, "The building is currently closed due to unsafe roof, so we've had to close it for safety reasons." They added that at this stage the Trust has not made any decisions regarding the long-term future of the building.
Football courts, or should that be pitches, at a popular Coventry park look set to get an upgrade, which includes a major change as to how they're currently used. The multi-use pitches in Longford Park, near the changing rooms off Windmill Road, will get newly laid turf, upgraded fences and brand new LED floodlights. The application for these changes, listed on Coventry City Council's planning portal, says that the upgrade will see the site look visibly quite similar, but with newer equipment replacing old and worn, and the addition of a few extras, including a proposed spectator area. The plans are part of the Football Foundation's Play Zone scheme, which aims to make sport and activity more accessible to all. The application explains, "Through consultation, Longford Park was chosen as a site that will benefit from the construction of a play zone facility. The play zone programme has been developed to tackle inequalities in physical activity and access to high quality facilities in targeted areas by the Football Foundation, providing funding towards community-led spaces. The purpose of the play zone scheme is to invest in areas with the greatest need, with the aim of encouraging specific priority groups to be more active: lower socioeconomic groups, women and girls, disabled people and people with long-term health conditions, plus ethnically diverse communities." It concludes, "This proposal would be of considerable benefit for local community groups. We recommend the proposals that are being requested, as they are not a dramatic adjustment in the existing visual appearance of the facility, but are a reasonable refurbishment, including future-proofing via the use of high-quality materials."
In last week's news, you heard about Reggie, the swan. And it appears that all's well that ends well for Reggie the Rogue Black Swan, nicknamed the Terminator in Stratford, because he has found love at last. Reggie had mysteriously appeared in Stratford last Christmas and had been terrorising its white mute swan population, soon earning a reputation as a hellraiser, attempting to drown the native mute swans and disrupting the nesting swans on the river. Reggie was then rehomed at the Dawlish Waterfowl Centre in Devon, and after just one day in Dawlish, it was like Romeo and Juliet's love story for Reggie, and with a happier ending than Shakespeare's character, as he and his new love are now enjoying life on a lake at a secret location. Don Phillips from the Dawlish Waterfowl Centre or Scylla as he might be termed, acting as matchmaker, set up Reggie with a blind date, Don explained. I put Reggie into the enclosure with two females, and he just walked up to them, and they sort of followed him around, and there was no aggression at all. He was just as good as gold. So I moved him onto a farm where they've got a big lake and ducks, and he settled in very well. I think he's picked his swan, his wife to be. Don said he believed Reggie had been behaving badly in Stratford because he was very frustrated, and the attention he was getting was just making him more that way inclined, a bit more aggressive. He concluded, since Reggie has been with us, he has been absolutely fantastic. He had been in the wrong environment, and since being here, he's transformed. He's a lovely bird, and as they say, birds of a feather stick together.
Indie band The Enemy are returning home to perform one of their famous rock anthems that's been adopted by Coventry City fans. The band will perform We Live and Die in These Towns live on Tuesday the 4th of November in front of an area of the Coventry Building Society arena known as Singer's Corner. The band, formed in Coventry in 2006, will play ahead of the Sky Blues home game against Sheffield United, which kicks off at 8 o'clock. Lead vocalist Tom Clark said he never imagined the song would become a much-loved anthem for football fans, and it was strange but humbling. He will perform alongside bass player Andy Hopkins and drummer Liam Watts. Tom Clark said, "When I wrote the song, I don't think I ever imagined it even being a single. It was just an acoustic track on the record. It wasn't the banger or the one the radio was going to love. It was a heartfelt moment telling the story about a girlfriend's flat in Coventry on Far Gosford Street." Released 18 years ago, the song peaked at just number 21 in the UK singles chart, but grew in popularity and has been adopted by Coventry City fans in recent years. He said, "It was never written to be an anthem. Something's happened to the song that's made it bigger than we could ever have made it. It's become bigger than the band. It'll outlive us. And that's happened with the spark of the crowd in the corner of the arena." The trio split in 2016 but reunited in 2022 for a UK tour to celebrate the 15th anniversary of their debut album. And a new UK tour is scheduled for 2025 with tickets going on sale in February.
Outlook News.
Thanks to our readers, Peter and Elaine. I do remember the day that Yoko Ono came very well indeed. It was actually Bob Eaton, who used to run the Belgrade Theatre, who actually invited her when he met her in America. But it was me that had to organise it. And I was terrified because she had such a fierce reputation. In fact, when she turned up, tiny figure in the biggest black limousine you've ever seen, she was absolutely wonderful. Really brilliant. Anyway,
wow.
Time's passed. There are a few notices this week, and I have to start on a sad note, I'm afraid. Pauline Lawrence, who many of you will remember, has died this week and was for many years a valuable member of the team. So RIP Pauline. Moving on, we've got some event information, particularly from local theatres. Three or four events that I need to tell you about. First of all, The Lightning Thief, the Percy Jackson musical, is a stage adaptation of Rick Riordan's best-selling novel, perfect for adventure, gods, half-bloods and mortals, apparently. That's on until Saturday at the Belgrade Theatre this week. Making a Killing, dark and razor-sharp comedy about justice, corruption and the cost of survival, is also on until Saturday at the Albany Theatre in the city. And next week there are some more theatre events you might be interested in. Lost Atoms, Anna Jordan's timeless tale, takes a wild ride through life-changing relationship, exploring how love shapes our lives and how we remember it. and that's at the Belgrade from next Tuesday the 21st to the Saturday the 25th. Talking Heads with Alan Bennett, the plays The Thing Theatre Company present two classic Alan Bennett monologues, A Lady of Letters and Soldiering on Thursday the 23rd of October at the Albany Theatre. We've got some kids theatre here. Stickman, lively stage adaptation of Julia Donaldson and Axel Schaffer's much-loved children's book, complete with puppetry, songs, live music and funky moves, from next Tuesday to Saturday at the Albany Theatre. And finally, an evening with Jimmy Anderson. Join the England fast bowler for an evening of never-before-heard stories from inside the changing room on Friday the 24th of October at Warwick Arts Centre. Some interesting things to go to there. Finally, before we move on, the lighting up times this week are 6:07 p.m. until 7:25 a.m. Right, next up is Hugh.
Hello. We've got, talking of the Warwick Arts Centre, I mentioned to you last week about Chris McCausland coming to Warwick Arts Centre, in November, but also in February. We had a list open, that list is now closed. We've had a number of people wanting to go, so that's fantastic. We'll arrange those with the people who have booked. We had a fantastic open day last week, last Thursday. We had, we weren't overrun with visitors, but actually we had really good quality visitors. We had a lot of opticians, I'm very pleased to say, who'd come and were exploring us for the first time. Karen has done, our outreach officer, that many of you will know, has done excellent work in engaging them. So I was very pleased to see so many opticians coming in and finding out more about what we do here, and those relationships, I'm sure, will develop into the future. We had a lot of people very interested in the Ray-Ban Meta glasses, and a lot of people, it was like that was busy all day. There was camped out in my office, and I was trying to do a little bit of work on the side sometimes, but they had a lot of people coming in and trying those out, and I think quite a lot of people were quite impressed. So it was Boots opticians who in Charlesmoor on Quinton Parade who were demonstrating those, and they definitely so they're definitely people to go to if you want to have a go with those yourself. You can go in and they will I would arrange a chat, you know, arrange beforehand to go in and give them a call, and they will, I'm sure, arrange a time to demonstrate them to you if you didn't get to us on open day. If you don't know their number, I don't either off the top of my head, but you can give us a call on 024 7671 7522, and that will and we will find the number, dig it out for you and give it to you. But we had lots of other people there. I was very pleased to see the NHS bowel cancer screening program there. It's not so subject that we often talk about for, I suppose, obvious cultural reasons, but it's really, really important. If you are of a certain age, you will be getting, hopefully, regular requests to send in a poo sample. And we know, we appreciate that for visually impaired people, that can be quite difficult sometimes, you know, to be comfortable, to really know what you're doing. If you get your pack through and you need some help, then we will point you in the right direction. I guarantee you we won't do it for you, but it's a really worthwhile thing that absolutely you must do if you get it, because that bowel cancer screening program has saved countless lives since it started, and so it's so I encourage you, and particularly chaps of a certain age, because you're the worst. So there we are. Now, coming up, on the 3rd of November, which is a Monday, from 10:30 a.m. to 1 p.m., Right here at Coventry Vision Hub, we will be holding the Coventry Accessible Voting Workshop and Device Demonstration Day. It's the title goes on, for blind and partially sighted residents. It's a bit of a mouthful. But this is an event that's been organised between the City Council and RNIB, and it is taking place here. So this is about helping to make voting more accessible for blind and partially sighted people. The RNIB research showed that in the last general election, only a quarter of blind people could vote independently and in secret, and that 73% of blind and partially sighted voters did not even know that they could request reasonable adjustments to enable them to vote. Accessible voting solutions are out there, but not enough to people know about them. So this workshop on the 3rd of November will be demonstrating how accessible voting works and device demonstration. So you can come along to share your past voting experiences, because I know some people have had really difficult past voting experiences. We hear about them every now and again. I mean, was it last year when there was about 4 elections in 1 year, give or take? We heard some people having problems, and you can learn how to request reasonable adjustments and accessible voting solutions, and you can also find out what provision will be available for the next election, as well as try out some devices that may help you to vote independently and in secret. The next local elections in Coventry are on the 7th of May in 2026, so this is a great opportunity to get up to speed with it. So this will be taking place in the Mary Beale Room on that Monday morning. Now, of course, we've got Monday Club operating in Boston Lodge at pretty much the same time. So if you tend to go to Monday Club and you would like to go to this, then that's fine. You don't need to do anything. But otherwise, if you need transport to come in, you'll need to let us know about it, and we will see what we can do. We can't necessarily guarantee transport in, but it would be good to see as many people there as possible. I should be sitting in on that one, I have to say, because I think it's important that as many of us as possible are aware of what the issues are. So that's 10:30 till 1 on Monday the 3rd of November in the Mary Beale Room, the Accessible Voting Workshop and Device Demonstration Day, the abbreviated title. Now, we are getting to that time of year when we have to think about next year and diaries and what have you. So we will be ordering the VIP diaries before the end of October. So if you want to get in there, you can leave an order with reception. The most popular ones are the A6 Pocket Diary. These are all weak to view. The A6 Pocket Diary, the A5 MIDI Diary. So A5 is like an A4 sheet of paper opened out, folded in half, rather, I beg your pardon. And then there's the A4 Desk Diary. So the A6 Pocket Diary, we'll be selling those for £7.15. The A5 MIDI Diary for £9.35. And the A4 Desk Diary for £10.50. You can also get A3 calendars. And you can have these in two styles. There's the Portrait Calendar, which... so it's a good large calendar, which will be £8.80. And then there's the landscape one, which actually gives you slightly bigger boxes, which is also £8.80. So there we are. That's nice and easy. So if you there's also telephone books and address books and what have you that we can help you with there if you want them. So we've had a number of orders already. But if you want a VIP diary, which are very good, very large print, very bold print, then do let us know. Particularly talk to reception, and they will put your order down. The exercise group is going well, but there are some spaces still on it. So the exercise group, so this is a bit more intense physical activity than any of our other exercise opportunities. It's on Wednesdays from 12 till 1. We have some spaces left. Now, this one, because we've got a tutor, like yoga, it's priced at £8 per session, and we're asking people for this one to pay in advance for a month. Now, this doesn't mean to say that, you know, if you know that you're going to be off, you can like just book out of that, and you know it won't come out. But we'd just like you to pay in advance so that we've got a better idea of numbers. So we can talk to you more about that. But if you're interested in it, you need to be able to get down on the floor and then get up again three times in a minute, and be able to walk for half an hour. Without needing to sit down, so that's there'll be a form that you have to fill in with somebody before then, called a Parcue form, and that's it. And then finally, gosh, we've got quite a lot this week, haven't we? The winter warmer is hoving into view, so that will be taking place on Saturday, the 29th of November. So it's sort of a pre-Christmas thing. We're hoping to. I think we're still colliding actually with Ilston Library, which has just landed on the same day. But anyway. They can switch between us. We do better food. so I have to say that our pumpkin harvest this year has been absolutely magnificent. So there will certainly be a pumpkin soup or butternut squash soup. I've got one that's about half a yard long, so, and probably about half a yard thick as well. So that may well be turning itself into soup at some point. So yeah, that's it for this week, and I think I'm back next week.
Thank you very much, Hugh. Busy times.
It's always busy.
Here's Sarah with this week's sport.
Well, hello there, lovely, lovely listeners. Now, two things before I start. Firstly, I am a traitor. What a waste of 90 minutes of my life watching that thing. Anyway, secondly, I just wanted to say that this week might be a tad shorter than normal because there really isn't a lot of sport at the moment, or certainly not the sport that I report on. So I'm going to start as usual with football. Now, it's been the friendlies and the World Cup qualifiers. And last week, I think it was Thursday, England played a friendly against Wales. Now, depending on which commentator on ITV you believe, it's a long time since Wales actually won on English soil. It could be 1977, 1984 or 2007. They kept changing their mind. But anyway, it's been a long time. Well, after 2 minutes, Morgan Rogers scored. Now, Morgan, despite his Welsh name, does play for England. Oh, and Aston Villa. 1-0 to England. And then in the 11th minute, his Aston Villa teammate, Ollie Watkins, put another on the score sheet. England 2-0. And not to be left out of it, Michaeli Saka made it 3 soon after. And that actually was how it finished, 3-0. I mean, you got the feeling that it could have been far more, but it didn't really matter. So why do they play these matches that don't really matter? Well, for sure, it gives the manager the opportunity to see how the players gel together and in different positions. But equally, it gives the players another opportunity to injure themselves, as happened to poor old Ollie Watkins, who collided with the upright on the goal. Ouch. I feel your pain. Meanwhile, Scotland had been playing World Cup qualifiers. Well, two of them to be precise. Having beaten Greece last Friday, they beat Belarus last night and are now sure of not necessarily automatic qualification, but definitely a place in the playoffs. Now, while we're sticking with the World Cup qualifiers, Wales take on Belgium tonight, today is Monday, and we play England play Latvia tomorrow night, knowing that a win will cement our place in the next round in the actual World Cup already. Come on, England, you can do it. Now, just looking at our two non-league sides that I cover, Leamington travelled up to Scarborough, and I do hope they took their trunk and sunscreen so they could get something out of the outing, because I'm afraid they lost 2-0. But Stratford stayed at home and entertained Sudbury and won 1-0. I understand Stratford are doing really well at the moment in their league, so long may it last. And finally on football, before I move on to the ovoid ball, just a quick reminder that the mighty Sky Blues, Coventry City, take on Blackburn Rovers next Saturday at 3 p.m. at the CBS Arena. And so, staying local but moving on to the ovoid ball, Coventry playing at Butts Park Arena this week, their first home match of the season, took on the Bedford Blues. Now, Bedford haven't actually won at Coventry for 16 years. Anyway, after 8 minutes, Coventry scored 7-0 up. But I'm afraid our Cov have a, capital letters, huge problem. They just give away too many penalties and get too many cards. You know, the cards that mean that players have to go off. Well, by half time, Bedford led 17-18. Now, all of the Bedford points had been scored by either them getting a penalty or when our player was off for 10 minutes having received a yellow card. So come on, Cov, if you're serious about business, you've got to clean your act up, I'm afraid. Well, it actually got worse in the second half, because in the second minute of the second half, one of the Coventry players received a red card and was sent off the field for the rest of the match. However, Coventry seemed to rally. It gave them a real kick up the backside or somewhere. And they scored 2 tries in quick succession. But then, slowly, as usually happens when one side is one player down, Bedford clawed their way back. And at one stage, have got the score to 32-30, and they got a conversion kick, which would have tied the scores. But they missed. And furthermore, Coventry scored. They got a penalty kick. And they ran out winners 35-30. So in the end and on the score sheet, it was a good match. But really, Cov, you've got to clean up your act. Meanwhile, in India and Pakistan, we have the Women's T20 World Cup. And our lasses are doing rather well. They now have 3 wins out of 3 matches played. Following on from their absolute thumping of South Africa, they had a closer match with Bangladesh and yesterday beat Sri Lanka by 80 runs. The only thing that worries me is there are 3 countries that haven't featured there: Australia, New Zealand, and India. Oh well, you can only play who your opposition are. And finally, have to tell you this because it made me smile. My friend phoned me the other day, really excited, and she said, Comfrey City have been featured on Radio 4. And thinking that they'd probably gone bust or something, which would be pretty incredible at the moment, I said, oh, why was that? Did you know, she said, they hadn't lost any of their matches this season and they're top of their division? Well, I sort of feigned a little bit of surprise, but then put some flesh on the tofu bones. And I've got another little, teeny little, finally, two names to give you. Strictly, Harry Aitkins Arite, Traitors, Claire Boulding. You heard it first on Sport. Have a lovely, lovely week, and thanks for putting up with me as usual. Bye!
Thanks to Sarah for this week's Sport. Here's Dave Monks with Postbag.
This is Postbag. Join in the discussion.
Hi there, and a big welcome to your Postbag this week. I'd like to begin by saying a big thank you to Tina and Marjorie for a lovely handmade congratulations card. Well done on receiving your award, David. You deserve it. Best wishes from Tina and Marjorie. Thank you very much, both of you, for your kind thoughts. It means a lot to me to have thanks from you. And Tina has been sending me and my lovely late wife, Sheila, handmade cards for years. And they've meant so much to me that I just don't want to throw them away. This card shows fishermen and their wives mending the nets. It reminds me of Graham and myself's recent break in Hull, where we learnt about how fishermen risk and often lose their lives bringing us fish for our plates. Thank you also to Graham Whale for your congratulations on my award too. And thank you also to Robert Franklin for telling me that I was mentioned in the news on Rugby Talking Newspaper, which I listened to. That meant a lot to me. And you've also been mentioned in dispatches too, Robert. The Monday Club have been saying how helpful and informative your talk was to them. And can I get more people like you who could tell them what help there is available to them as visually impaired people? Well, you're welcome to come back, Robert. And also Jag Singh, who said you would like to give a talk to the Monday Club, and anybody else as well. Robert told the Monday Club about what help he has going on holiday to Tynmouth by train. Well, he went to Tavistock while he was there, and he made use of Dawlish Community Transport, which is on 01626 888890, which I think you have to book beforehand. Robert has sent me information about rail cards. There is some information about the disabled person's rail card. The price for 1 year is £20, for 3 years is £54. You may qualify if you are in receipt of a disability-related benefit, or have a visual or hearing impairment, or have epilepsy. One adult travelling with you can get a third off most rail fares, which is good news. And you can buy a rail card online at railcard.co.uk with scan proof of eligibility, or by post with completed application form, payment and proof of eligibility to National Rail Cards, P.O. Box 8626, Swadlincote, DE11 1JA. Disabled person's rail card is not available to buy at National Rail ticket offices. Thank you, Robert, very much. Now we have a bit more from former chairperson of the Talking Newspaper, Bob Syme. He talked last week about having three guide dogs, but when he applied for a fourth one, he said that the Guide Dogs for the Blind charity didn't get back to him. So he's now got a non-guide dog from the Dogs Trust. Bear in mind that these are Bob Syme's personal experiences and opinions, and it does not necessarily apply to you.
I never heard a thing from Guide Dogs. Nothing at all. So I phoned Tony Murray, who's the head trainer at Guide Dogs, last year. And I says, I'm going to go to Kenilworth Dog Trust if I don't hear anything about a dog getting a guide dog. I'm on my own, and I have been for the last 6.5 years. And he's never inquired how I could get to the shops or how was I managing getting my grocery, my food all in, and was I managing without a dog? Not a word from you after everything I've done. Starting the Coventry branch of Guide Dogs and raising all the money, running concerts in different clubs all over Coventry. I says, I take a poor view of it. He says, well, don't go to the dog trust. I'll get you a dog by the new year, by Christmas. Unfortunately, he never actually mentioned what Christmas. But I took it for the last Christmas gone. I said, I'm going to go to the dog trust. No, don't bother. I'll get you a dog. I'll do everything I can. I'm moving into a bigger area. So I left it. No, I think. I never read anything whatsoever until last January. They sent an email to my cousin who receives my emails. Would I give up a day on the 21st of January to get myself over to Leamington, take a packed lunch, and train different dogs for the public, all different dogs. We haven't got a dog for you, they said, but we want you to come and train, show off our dogs working. We want you to do it for us. I said, no. I told my cousin, reply to him, no, I'm not. They've never even bothered about me. So a lady phoned me and she says, I've took over from Tony Murray. I says, oh, where are you from then? She says, Guide Dogs. And she says, we wondered why you refused to come and help for the public to show the dogs working. I says, you've never contacted me. You should have been kept informed. I says, I know I should have done, but should have been, but I haven't been. Not one of you has ever phoned. And she says, well, Tony Murray did in September. I says, no, he didn't. I phoned him and told him I was going to the doctor's, which I'd already done. And I'd got my dog. I've had my dog, I say, 12 months. Since I taught her to go down to the road and everything. But she's not on harness, but she's fantastic. And the lady says, well, I've took over from Tony Murray. I want to sort out what's gone wrong. I'm going to have a full inquiry into this. I was already said about the waiting list, she said to me. There's a good waiting. I says, I know. She says, some people have to wait about a year. And what we do, if they're on their own and they've been struggling to get out, they won't be able to walk so good. I said, well, you're not going to keep them waiting another year, surely. She says, yeah, we keep them waiting another year, and then when we go and see them again, I said, well, they'll be far worse. She says, exactly. We don't have to provide them with a guide dog then. I says, you're not serious, you're joking, are you? She says, no, that's exactly what we do. We leave them for another year. I says, and I've been raising all this money for guide dogs, and you do that? She says, exactly, that's what we do.
Thank you, Bob. Let us have your experiences with guide dogs. As I mentioned earlier in Bob's personal opinions, it would not necessarily apply to you. There are examples in the resource centre of the good work guide dogs do, and Bob had three guide dogs from them that gave him a lot of independence. Guide Dogs are a big national charity, though. Remember your local charity, Coventry Vision Hub, that helps you and gives you the personal touch. They're not likely to forget about you. There are two guide dogs, that come to the Monday Club every week. There's Gemma's dog, Robin, and Andy's dog, Evans. Member of the Monday Club, Elizabeth, loves them both and tells their owners, if ever your dog goes missing, you won't have to look very far. I'll have half hitched him. Elizabeth discovered a little-known castle recently. She didn't know it existed, despite living not far away. Here's Elizabeth to tell you about it.
Hi, everyone. This week, feeling the need for a breath of fresh air to blow away the cobwebs, I ventured to Baggington and ended up at Baggot's Castle, which is maintained entirely by volunteers. They worked tirelessly to keep it looking shipshape. A lovely German lady named Henny provided tea, coffee and a scrumptious slice of apple cake. Henny's colleague informed us of a little of the history of Baggot's Castle, going back to the 14th century. There are six inquisitive black and white Baggot goats there, each individually named. Adjacent to the remains of the castle stands a large summer house and a bluebell wood. Apparently, King Richard II stayed at the castle before the duel on Gosford Green that he called off.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth, for that lovely report. Really well read. Baggot's goats were thought to be brought back to Europe by Richard the Lionheart, and Richard II, he gave them to Sir William Baggot. William Baggot was described as that creature to the king by Shakespeare. Shakespeare described the setting for the duel on Gosford Green between Sir Thomas Mowbray and Sir Henry Bolingbroke. Richard heard what the argument was about, deliberated it for about 2 hours, and as Elizabeth said, called the duel off. And then he had them banished abroad. 4 years later, Henry Bolingbroke came back and deposed the king and declared himself Henry IV. Before the would-be duel, Henry stayed at Kenilworth Castle, and Sir Thomas Mowbray rode out on a charger decorated with mulberry leaves from Caledon Castle. All three castles are worth a visit. And that's all there is in Postbag this week. Okay, so please let's hear from you next time. There's lots of interesting things to talk about. Where have you been? Have you found some interesting, fascinating places? I bet you have. And just tell us what you've been doing in life and any tips you might have to pass on to your fellow listeners, or any thoughts arising from any of the articles on Outlook, including the news. Okay, so thank you very much, and bye for now.
This is Outlook. You can contact Postbag.
Our website is www.talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Our email address is postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Join in the discussion on Postbag.
And that's all we have for you from Postbag this week. Dave Monks will return with all your thoughts next week. Our wander down Warwickshire Way this week takes us to the village and parish of Newbold, Pacey and Ashbourne, some 5 miles south of Stratford-on-Avon. It's a small place with a population of less than 300, but a well-preserved one. It has 20 listed buildings. And Elaine is our guide.
Newbold Pacey is the older of the two places, Newbold Pacey being at one time the village and Ashbourne the hamlet. Local folklore say that Ashbourne came about when a gentleman named Edward Carew came to Newbold Pacey to escape the plague in London, but brought it with him. The villagers then crossed Ouseley Brook to escape the plague and built their houses in Ashbourne. Ashbourne is an Anglo-Saxon word for north-east, so it signifies the north-east corner of the parish. There is a monument to Edward Carew and his infant daughter in the church. This monument was brought from the previous church, which was partly wooden. The present church was designed by J.L. Pearson, who was also the architect of Truro Cathedral. There are a few interesting monuments in the church, one to a past vicar who was nephew of the poet Southey, and another to somebody who was a martyr to the gout. It is rumoured that a lot of cottages in New Boldpacey were burnt down and never rebuilt, so that only a few remain today. The old vicarage has an exact replica in Virginia in the USA. In Ashourne, the oldest houses are around the green, except Stonehouse Farmhouse, which is mentioned in the Domesday Book. Several of the houses are Wattle and Daub, the mall being collected from the Holloway, which is now a C-class road. At one time, this was the only way in and out of the villages. In more recent times, the village has built a new village hall, which replaced a hut dating from the First World War. Unfortunately, like a lot of places, the village has lost its school, post office and shop, and the chapel has been sold and converted into a house. One of the local large houses, Ashourne Hill, was once owned by Mr. Bryant of Bryant and May Matches, and was bought by the iron and steel industry during the Second World War as their headquarters. It is now a management college. There is a cricket field, which is the only one in the country where you cross water to get from the pavilion to the field. In the adjoining Ashourne House at one time lived Major Booch, whose uncle was the builder of the doomed Tay Bridge. As in countless English villages, Newbold and Ashourne now have little to offer in the way of employment. Thus, families which have lived in the parish for many generations have to look elsewhere for jobs. As they commute to nearby towns, so do newcomers to the village. There is still a significant number of family names which appeared in the 1851 census and whose grandparents feature as children in the 1869-70 logbook of the village school.
From one impressive collection of historic buildings to another, in the second part of The Secrets of the Pyramids, Nigel explains that life was not easy on the building site.
Life was not easy on the building site. Another previously unexplored consequence of the construction has emerged, the unification of Egypt as a nation. Although they weren't slaves forced into hard labour, as is common misconception, in some ways the builders did not give their time freely. Records of local leaders show that there was an obligation to the pharaoh to supply men for such projects, in much the same way as feudal kings relied on their nobles to supply men-at-arms in times of war. There is also a possibility that men gave their labour instead of taxes. DNA testing of the remains of workers from the guise of village clearly demonstrates that the workers workforce came from all over Egypt, fulfilling an obligation and answering their pharaoh's call as homage to their god king. As a result, men and women from all parts of the kingdom came together, shared their lives, learned new skills, made new friends, and returned home with a greater sense of unity, having been part of a lasting legacy to their all-powerful ruler. To match the organisational discipline the workforce, there had to be a skill and precision of the planning and calculations required for such a tremendous project. Many of the questions still debated today revolve around the details of construction. While there is some accepted common ground, differences still remain. For those trying to solve the mystery, it has been essential to place themselves in the minds of those ancient designers and architects and ask them very fundamental questions, such as, what are we trying to achieve, and what knowledge do we have to achieve it? We know that at the time of the construction of the Great Pyramid, the Egyptians didn't have the wheel, nor did they have pulleys or iron tools. What they did have, however, was the knowledge and instruments to measure level surfaces and angles, both essential for precision on an amazing scale, even by modern standards. As for tools, they had the know-how to use sand and other abrasives to turn copper saw into a much more efficient instrument that could cut through relatively soft limestone and even larger granite blocks with surprising success. The debate around the construction of the Pyramid of Khufu falls quite neatly into some very simple questions. How did they move such large blocks? Without the wheel, it's generally accepted that they were able to construct sleds on which the stone blocks could be pulled, while the ground was lubricated with water to reduce friction. Such a sled is displayed in excellent condition in the Museum of Cairo, and there are examples of tomb decoration showing statues being pulled into place on one. Timber was a rare commodity in Egypt, with much of it coming from Lebanon, and so the sleds would be well maintained and could be recycled into perhaps roof beams or even beds or furniture when they were no longer needed. Perhaps the most controversial question is just how the huge blocks of limestone and later the even bigger blocks of granite were manoeuvred into place with such breathtaking precision, with joints of only half a millimetre, onto a monument as it rose higher and higher from the ground. The essential starting point for construction was a level base. In the 1880s, Sir Flinders Petrie surveyed the site and concluded that the area had been dug with shallow channels and flooded so that the water established the true level, and the stone worked into the flat surface between. This idea was developed by Leher 100 years later, with the hypothesis that only an area suitable for sufficient foundation was levelled. Whichever method was used, the base of the pyramid is flat to within an astonishing 15 millimetres. Many experts agree that in order to get such huge blocks of stone into place, they must have used a ramp. The burning question is, what kind? It's now widely understood a straight one on at right angles to the structure is the least likely answer to the mystery. The main reason for this is the sheer size of the structure required, almost as bulky as the pyramid itself, and the steepness of the angle required to reach the higher points, which would be beyond the capabilities of a sled drawn by humans. Perhaps more promising is the zigzag ramp, which would snake up one side of the structure with shorter lengths at a less steep angle. The main issue would be keeping it fixed to the exterior of the structure as it grew. By introducing a spiralling ramp supported by the body of the structure itself, the architects would overcome a number of logistical obstacles. First of all, the angle would be shallow enough for the effective pulling of the blocks. Second, it would not have to be fixed to the ground outer surface of the pyramid, but rise on top of each layer as it progressed in height. Third, the final top section of the pyramid would be put in place using levers in very much the way as described by Herodotus, in order to then fix the finely finished outer layer. The whole process would be done in reverse and the ramp dismantled as they went. Perhaps the most frustrating aspect of the pyramid's construction is the lack of any records revealing the construction techniques used on them. But the more recent work that has been undertaken moves us ever more forward in our knowledge and to resolving the mystery of once and for all.
To mark the final chapter of television's Downton Abbey, Sam Worcester from the Daily Express takes us behind the scenes at Highclere Castle, where it was filmed. This is the first of a two-part feature, read by Margaret.
Aristocrats and A-listers visiting the lavish real-life set of Downton Abbey usually arrive in a chauffeur-driven car with an assistant on hand for any luggage. On the day I meet the 8th Countess of Carnarvon at Highclere Castle, I'm clad in an elegant designer top with my hair perfectly coiffed, but thanks to my supermarket bag for life and minicab, there's no disguising my commoner roots. Highclere is, of course, the country estate in Hampshire recognised the world over as the majestic main character in Julian Fellowes' epic drama. There might not be a lineup of staff on the drive to greet my less than aristocratic entrance, but nonetheless, I'm nervous. I'm about to come face to face with castle owner Lady Fiona Carnarvon, a real-life blue blood, who just 100 years before would have only glanced my way to check I hadn't missed a spot of dust on the silverware. It's thanks to social mobility that I'm here at all, and as we know, with nobility, first impressions count. Lady Carnarvon can be found perched on the corner of a desk inside an ordinary office room where her closest household allies help her plan the day ahead. She's busy getting to grips with the nitty-gritty of her hectic schedule amid a cacophony of ringing mobiles. Like a below-stairs maid who's taken a wrong turn, I stand nervously resisting the urge to curtsy. I extend my hand for a firm, but not too firm, as a school careers advisor once counselled, handshake, and introduce myself as Sam, a name the upper classes admittedly struggle with at the best of times. Ladies see, as she likes to be known, politely ask if I've travelled far. Essex, I respond, waiting to see if smelling salts might be required, just like Michelle Dockery. The smile she shoots back tells me I never had any reason to worry. For the last 15 years, Downton Abbey has captivated millions of fans with its dramatic storylines, stunning sets and witty dialogue. Featuring screen stalwarts Dame Maggie Smith, Hugh Bonneville and Jim Carter, it also launched the careers of the aforementioned Dockery, Lily James and Dan Stevens. And after 6 seasons and 2 successful films, the 3rd cinematic installation, the grand finale, is revealed. To coincide with the momentous finale, Lady C has written A Year at Highclere, Secrets and Stories from the Real Downton Abbey, providing a candid account of life now and then inside the famous centuries-old pile with a vivid story of its own. And the 61-year-old who moved to the Grand Estate in 2001 with her husband Geordie, the 8th Earl of Carnarvon, following his father's death, has granted the Daily Express an exclusive interview to share her filming secrets. Highclere's records stretch back to an astonishing 748 AD, with a lineage that includes the renowned Egyptologist Lord Carnarvon, who discovered the tomb of Tutankhamun, and, as legend has it, succumbed to its infamous curse. The responsibility of stewarding a Grade 1 listed national treasure is immense, and Lady Carnarvon and Geordie are acutely aware of this. I hope we come across as just a hard-working couple, you know, ones who graft like everyone else, she says. And graft they do. When film crews descend upon Highclere, it's a meticulously orchestrated affair. They arrive at 6 a.m. outside and 7 a.m. inside the house, she explains. So you hear all the vans drive up. While her husband Geordie handles the initial welcome, she uses the early hours for emails before the 11-hour filming day truly begins. Constant coordination with the housekeeping team and film crew is required to ensure rooms are ready and valuable artifacts are kept safe at all times, as Lady C explains. One of the staterooms is always off limits as it has a signed fire exit in it, so that provides a really good excuse to keep it to ourselves, and that's the side of the house that has everything that shouldn't really be touched by anybody, such as vases and other heirlooms. Inevitably, there are mishaps. On the evening before the first day of filming in March 2010, she and Geordie made sure they'd moved their most prized possessions to a safe place, but they forgot one item. We noticed a green lacquered objet de vertu, an antique box, on a table opposite the fireplace, explains Lady C. I assured Geordie it would be fine, but it didn't last the day, as a lighting boom fell on it. The crew were mortified, and it took 6 months for me to find someone able to repair it. I felt dreadfully guilty, but my husband very kindly did not say, I told you so. She adds with a knowing smile, we always say you must have a good sense of British humour to work here. If you get on with Fawlty Towers and the two Ronnies, then you sort of fit in at Highclere, basically. Much of their glassware and crockery was rented after that, but over the next 15 years the cast became friends, with many returning between filming to stay at Highclere as guests of the family. Lady C soon learned that an actor's life consists of a moment's deliverance following an age-old wait. We often saw Jim Carter hanging around outside while the others were filming, she laughs. He is a really nice man. He'd have to sit outside all bloody day waiting to say, "You rang, my lord," or whatever. But she soon learned it's not about which actor has the most lines or most camera time, but what they do with it. Maggie Smith always made her words fill out, she remembers. I learned so much from watching her. She didn't have a huge presence in any of the episodes because she was filming other projects, including Harry Potter and the Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. But yet, with just one line or the one scene that she did, everybody remembers it. It was like magic. What is a weekend?
From a castle called Highclere to a high-flying mum, Bill Gibbs talks to Candy Adkins for the People's Friend magazine. This is read by Elaine.
Candy Adkins can clearly remember her mum, Jackie Mogridge, telling her that nothing was impossible in life. Adventure, pushing boundaries, and achieving what you wanted could be a reality, not a dream. Jackie was a shining example of everything she passed on to Candy and led a remarkable life, breaking down barriers and proving herself a pioneering legend in a man's world. She flew more than 1,400 aircraft during World War II, ferrying planes between airfields to help get crews in the air and keep Britain's skies safe. She went on to become one of literally a handful of women to gain RAF wings before taking to the air once more as Britain's first woman commercial airline captain. She wasn't like other mums, Candy says, as she talks about her mum's achievements. She'd play tennis with me, climb a mountain with me, and she brought us up to believe anyone could do anything, because she thought she could. She didn't see barriers and didn't understand any time she got knocked back. After becoming the first woman in her native South Africa to do a parachute jump, 18-year-old Jackie came to Oxford to follow her dream to be a pilot in 1938. When World War II broke out the following year, she was soon the youngest woman in the ranks of the Air Transport Auxiliary. The ATA's role was to take aircraft from factories or ferry them back, often damaged, and among the aircraft Jackie flew were 668 Spitfires, many in a perilous state. They'd take them back to be decommissioned, and they called that the graveyard run. She'd get into a cockpit, find a note saying the undercarriage didn't work properly and have to land without it. A lot of runways were grass, and she found she could gently land without damage. The women had a brilliant safety record. There was a lot of prejudice and obstacles, and Jackie became one of only five women to be promoted in the RAF in 1953. She was very proud to get her wings, but it was rescinded just 2 weeks later, Candy says. I'm not sure she knew that, as she always called herself Flying Officer. I wrote to them to ask why, and they said it was an error, as women weren't allowed to be promoted. Jackie went on to find a place in the record books as the UK's first commercial airline captain in 1957, flying daily to the Channel Islands and throughout Europe. Once again, she found herself in a male domain. Although she was the captain, she wasn't allowed to make tannoy announcements in case passengers became alarmed to hear a woman's voice, Candy said. Jackie died in 2004, and her ashes were scattered by a Spitfire over a Devon airfield. But her story is told in her book, Spitfire Girl, and her life is celebrated through her daughter's talks. What she and other women did wasn't written in the history books, and I want to change that and keep the story alive.
Dave Monks reports on the BBC CWR Make a Difference Award staged at the Belgrade Theatre. And didn't he do well?
Hello there, I'm speaking to you from the Belgrade Theatre for the BBC CWR Make a Difference Awards. And I've been nominated for the Great Neighbour category. And by Cheryl Burton, the daughter of one of our late listeners, Gwen Edge. Graham, here's Graham. You've seen a celeb.
Pete Waterman,
oh yeah, the music mogul. Right, I'm speaking to pop mogul and train enthusiast Pete Waterman at the moment. So how do you feel about being here for the BBC CWR Make a Difference Awards?
That's fantastic. Yeah, it's... When I was asked to do it, I just said yes. I didn't have to think about it. No. So, you know, not a great day to be in Coventry. It's pouring down the rain, but there you go. Can't have everything.
My name is Councillor Wim Saru, the Mayor of Nuneaton and Bedworth, as you said.
Thank you. So how do you feel about coming here to the BBC CWR Make a Difference Awards?
It's great. I'm so glad that, you know, people are getting recognised by BBC Coventry, which is good, really good. There are a lot of people, you know, who work so hard to make a difference, and then to be recognised by, like, BBC Warwick or Coventry is really good.
The Make a Difference Awards ceremony is about to begin. In the Make a Difference Awards, there are various categories, like the Great Neighbour Award and the Community Hero Award. I went to speak to some of the nominees. So what's your name?
It's Valerie, and this is Rosie, my working Cocker Spaniel.
Okay, and Rosie helps children read.
She does. She's part of the Pets of Therapy Read to Dog programme, and so every Wednesday we go into Bilton Junior School, and Rosie spends the afternoon there, and a group of children come to read her. They come individually, and they bring a book of their choice, and they spend 15 minutes reading to Rosie, and stroking her.
Yeah, I really understand the reasoning behind that. Yeah, it's easier to read to a dog, isn't it?
It is. They're an unconditional, non-judgmental, very loving audience.
So what's your name?
My name's Paul Quinn.
So you've been nominated for something?
Yeah, for the fundraising award.
One fundraising? So what have you raised funds for?
So I run a festival called Coftember, which has been going since 2018. So I've raised money for Mind, Crisis, the Air Ambulance, local food banks, and Zoe's Place. And this year we're doing it for Mighton Hospital, because I always choose a charity that's close to Coventry, to Coventry's heart. And I'm using Mighton this year because my wife has stage 4 cancer, and she's been going to Mighton for treatment and stuff. I'm picking up this year. So we've raised over 12 grand since 2018. So
how have you been raising funds?
Basically, we put on a 3-day festival.
Music festival.
Music festival, sorry, yeah.
I'm speaking to a gentleman with a dog now. Is it a spaniel?
He's a Welsh Springer Spaniel, yes.
Yeah.
He's not here for a charity thing. We do support the charity, which is Dogs Trust, but he's here for the award, the Eco-Friendly Award for picking up plastic bottles.
Yeah, is he?
Yeah, so he picked up, he's 8 years old, and we reckon he's picked up about 10,000 plastic bottles.
Oh, wow, that's wonderful. Okay, hello, I'm speaking to a farmer now. What's your name?
Martin Brandreth.
What did you get the award for? You're a farmer.
I'm a farmer, yeah. It was a fundraising award for our Christmas tractor run.
Yeah.
Loads of tractors dressed up with Christmas lights.
I know, it's a fantastic sight as well. Right, I'm speaking to a lady with a lovely dog called Benji. What's your name?
My name's Sean.
Okay, can you tell me about Benji, please?
Well, Benji is a Blue Merle Pedigree Border Collie, and he's also a therapy dog.
You take him round hospitals, homes and that?
Yeah, we go to the Nuneaton Psychiatric Hospital once a fortnight.
Good, yeah.
We go to Mary Ann Evans Hospice, the youth club, of course, which is where we won the award,
yeah.
And also a stay and play group and numerous care homes.
I was speaking to a friend of Benji, that's Emma. So how do you know Benji?
So I know Benji because he comes along to youth club. He's a therapy dog, so he comes along to Binley Woods Youth Club every week and, yeah, supports the young people, and it's just like that calming presence in youth club.
I'm speaking to Sue at the moment, so what do you do?
Well, I'm a volunteer in the local community, and I organise a coffee morning every week on a Tuesday, and sometimes we have fundraising. We do 3 fundraisers a year, one at Easter, one at Christmas. We donate the money to local charities.
Multi-millionaire pop mogul Pete Waterman was the judge in the Great Neighbour Award, and I was nominated in that category.
Next up in this category, it's David Monks.
On the big screen at the Belgrade Theatre, they showed an interview that BBC CWR presenter Phil Upton did with me, where he asked me how long had been at Coventry Vision Hub. And I said I'd been with Coventry Vision Hub before the building had started, a long time. And I've been helping with Coventry Talking Newspaper for over 42 years, which is now part of Coventry Vision Hub, formerly the Resource Centre. I like to help people talk to each other, to share information, as far as the Talking Newspaper is concerned, because there's a lot of experience that blind and partially sighted people have that they can share with other people in similar circumstances. And they can help each other in life. And then, Judge Pete Waterman, in a video, gave his verdict.
Well, this year's BBC CWR Make a Difference Awards, I've been given the task of judging the Great Neighbour Award. Although they're all worthy contenders, one shook a chord with me, and that's David Monks. I think the volunteers sometimes have to go that extra mile. And I think all of the guys were fantastic, but David just stood out as going that extra mile and doing something different. He's all inclusive. He is, obviously loves it. And his lifelong commitment to it is fantastic. So my vote goes for David.
Well, thank you. And for Paul and Graham, my two sons, for coming along to support me. And that's all from the BBC CWR Make a Difference Awards 2025. Bye!
That just about brings us to the end of this week's programme, so it's goodbye from the Outlook team and from me, Peter Walters.